Hello and welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Just in case you wondered, and if you are or are related to a woman struggling to get ahead to earn a decent living or get a decent education, you just might be wondering. When it comes to the bottom line, women in Ohio aren't doing so well. Here in Columbus, home to arguably the biggest public university in the nation, it's hard to imagine, but as a state, Ohio ranks 39th among states for the percentage of women with 4 or more years of college. That's according to a report released last month by the Ohio State University's Institute on Women, Gender, and Public Policy. The same report says that the Buckeye State ranks 33rd for the percentage of state legislative seats held by women. That's definitely a downturn from about 20 years ago. And women continue to lag far behind men in Ohio in earning power. To give us some context for these numbers and to tell us why it should matter to women, girls, and everybody else, we're joined today by Julie Graber, Senior Associate for Strategic Planning at the Institute. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
And also joining us today is Nicole Dunn. She's president and CEO of the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, only the second president and CEO of the Women's Fund. So we'll want you to tell us a little bit more about that because it's sort of new. It's about 6 or 7 years old, right?
That's correct.
Okay. If you would like to get in on this conversation, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tell us your own stories about getting ahead despite the apparent odds. Julie, I assume the educational and elective office categories in your study were highlighted because they surprised you.
Well, probably not because they surprised me, because I've been looking at the numbers for a long time. They've been issues for women in Ohio for at least the last 10 years. It just changes have taken place. So, but they really relate to each other in that when you look at some of the issues that impact women economically, you can also be looking at what kinds of public policies might address those issues. And having more women in the state legislature makes the likelihood of doing that higher. So they are two issues that are interrelated to some extent that we need to address.
How do you explain it generally? Do you just have the data? How do you explain this low rate and how Ohio compares nationwide?
Well, I think generally you look at what's happened in the economy here in Ohio, and not just recently, but you have to go back. You know, the changes that are taking place in the demands of the workforce, it's requiring folks to have more education in order to have the ability to earn a decent wage. And we just need to catch up on some of these things. And, you know, it's something there's a focus on now in terms of how do we prepare the current workforce for the jobs that we hope to grow in the state.
It seems like you can't walk down the street without bumping, you know, tripping over an institute of higher learning somewhere. But the women aren't getting into them, or they're not graduating from them.
Well, actually, it's an interesting stat because people have heard the fact that women make up the majority of college students these days, mm-hmm. and they make up the majority of college graduates. But it's certainly an issue of catch-up. The other issue here in Ohio that everyone acknowledges is that we've had in the past a tendency not to fund higher education at the same level as other states. And the result of that is that the cost of higher education in Ohio had really skyrocketed for a while, way out of line with what was going on in other states. So when you look at the development of a workforce that really needs something beyond a high school diploma, but the cost of that is often out of reach for a lot of families, then you start to run into these economic issues that affect women, affect everyone, but affect women in very specific ways.
You can probably calculate them in terms of the point of diminishing returns, where you start to increase the tuition at a university, you can see how many fewer people are going to be going there because of their income level, how many people can afford it.
Mm-hmm.
And often those are women.
Well, yes. I mean, and there are some places in the state where there still isn't a priority placed on young women getting an education beyond high school. And that's a message that especially now with the demands of what jobs need in order for folks to be able to be successful in them. There's clearly got to be a message that you've got to go beyond high school, whether it's a four-year degree or, the other alternative is to look at the skilled trades as the green economy grows in Ohio. It's just high school diploma for a woman just isn't enough anymore.
The numbers that you were looking at, you looked at the whole state, but the major urban areas are comparable to each other?
Pretty much so, yes. And, besides the overall number, which is 23% of women in Ohio, 25 years and older, have four or more years of college, you look at race. For African-American women, the percentage is 14.3%, I think, percentage. If you look at the 29 counties that are part of Appalachia, it's 12 to 14% for women in terms of having four or more years of college. And you see a pattern when you compare urban areas to rural areas in the state. Urban areas are a place where folks who do have a college education tend to find jobs, and the percentages are higher.
Okay. What about what can you do in those rural areas? They're rural. It's hard to get access to higher ed. It's hard to get access to the skilled trade schools. A lot of people, that's where they live. Do you bring it to them, or how do you change that?
Well, Ohio has a decent number of institutions of higher education, and you include in that a lot of the community colleges, which are a great place for a lot of students to get the first 2 years of college. Those first 2 years can also prepare you to go into some of the apprenticeship programs for the skilled trades. So making sure that folks do have easy access to higher ed is critical, but I think we've got it in the state. I think some of what the legislature's been doing in terms of investing in higher ed, we're going to start to reap some of the benefit from that in the next couple of years.
I was looking at another one of your reports on it looked at the responses from high school juniors completing the PSAT,
mm-hmm.
and what they were I guess it's what their college major plans were for college-bound juniors in Ohio 2007-2008. And some of the startling differences to me, I didn't realize there was such a disparity. For engineering, 16.2% of the males respondents said that they were headed toward a career in engineering, but only 6% of the girls. Business management, 13.6% of the boys, 7% of the girls. Engineering technology, 3.2% of the boys, 0.3% of the girls. It sort of wasn't the same sort of parallel all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
How is that if you're starting out of the box with heading toward more traditional, lower paying jobs, education, unfortunately, health professions still considered lower paying, unless you're going into becoming a physician or that sort of a thing. Psychology, communications, liberal arts, and humanities, women are there's a lot of parity for these girls in terms of what they're choosing. But how does that disparity play out in the future?
Well, the interesting you see the traditional kind of stereotypical breakdown there. And what that tells us in part is that even though we have these programs that encourage young women to look at the STEM fields, for example, there's still a lot of work to be done, and that message needs to be reinforced over and over again. One interesting note, a researcher at Ohio State, Donna Bobbitt-Zayer, just released some research findings that shows that the choice of college major actually has more impact on the gender wage gap now than it did 10 years ago. So the choices young women make about what fields to go into and what careers to pursue has an even more critical impact on their ability to land a high-wage job in the future.
Okay. Also joining us, Nicole Dunn from the Women's Fund of Central Ohio. Tell us about the Women's Fund first, because I don't think you've been on this show before or been in this on the air before to tell us about it, and how its work dovetails with the data from this latest report from OSU.
Sure. Thanks, Anne. The Women's Fund has been around for 8 years now. We just celebrated our eighth anniversary since our inception and founding. And so we are approaching our $1 millionth in grant making. And so we are a foundation that raises dollars that goes back into the community of Central Ohio, which is Franklin County and the six contiguous states. And what we fund is social change for women and girls. We define social change as creating a long-term systemic impact in three specific areas. And what we've identified as those areas is life skills for girls, leadership for women and girls, and then economic independence. So the last is what you can see ties directly into some of the research that you're talking about, directly talking about the statistics that Julie's speaking of when you're talking about the workforce, education, and most particularly, we just completed a research project called One Girl, and looking at not just beginning in college, the choices that are made, and going into the workforce as women, as adults, but what's happening with the girls today.
I think it's interesting how you have actively involved the girls. You're going out to the high schools, you're recruiting them, and they don't just get the money. They help hand it out. Tell me about the grant-making process there.
Thanks for asking that question, because we are – part of our mission is increasing philanthropy. And what does philanthropy look like in the auspice of time, talent, and, yes, treasure, the money that needs to go out, but it's about giving of your time and the skill set to make those decisions. And so when you look at the decisions that women make about consumerism and philanthropy, again, beginning with girls. So part of our grant reader program that decides where the money should be invested is involving girls to read the grant applications, to use critical thinking, and make a decision. Should this grant be funded? What do they think about it? Score it using a metrics and then participating in a conversation with other women and really changing their minds too sometimes, asking questions that women in their 30s, 40s, 70s that have been, you know, making grants and investing their money in philanthropy for a long time, challenging them, saying, is this really what girls want today? Is this really what's going to make an impact and change lives?
Women already tend to, though, give more a higher percentage of their income to philanthropy, regardless of how much they earn themselves. Why is that? Is that the same sort of thing as women used to be social workers before it was a paid profession too?
Perhaps. In fact, I can tell you what that number is, and that's that women give an average of 3.5% of their wealth versus 1.8% of what men make, and that is based on the fact of what you just said, that women earn less. So you're talking about not just doubly giving more than men, but it's almost quadruple when you take into effect of the average earned income. And there's something innate about women that drives that philanthropy. And we found that even in our girls' research, that girls are more likely to be involved in volunteerism and in their community. So there is something genetically somewhat dispositioned about women to and that goes back to invest in a girl and you end up investing in a woman, investing in the community to change the neighborhood and the greater scope.
And it also says something about how we value things. We value teachers. We pay them only so much. Women traditionally go into that role. I wonder if what came first, the chicken or the egg. Mm-hmm. We got to take a break right now. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a recent report by OSU's Institute on Women, Gender, and Public Policy that shows Ohio is lagging in indicators of women's advancement. When we return, we'll talk about whether these sorts of statistics influence Ohio's well-documented brain drain. What do you think? Call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org and let us know. We'll be right back. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Thurber House, presenting Evenings with Authors guest Sue Miller, reading from her latest novel, The Senator's Wife, Monday evening, September 14th at the Columbus Museum of Art. Tickets at thurberhouse.org.
And good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Amy Jurevich. 74 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20. Supporting WOSU is easier than ever. Just visit our website, WOSU.org, and click on the Pledge Now box along the left margin. Whether you're a first-time member or looking to renew your membership, your online gift is more important than ever. Thank you for your support of WOSU 820 NPR News. In the weather forecast for today, some sunshine and also a slight chance of rain this afternoon, a high of 78 degrees. Clouds tonight with a slight chance of evening rain and a low of 55. Some sunshine for Thursday and a very slight chance of afternoon rain and a high of 78. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about women's status and the lagging indicators of women's advancement in the state of Ohio. Joining me today is Julie Graber, Senior Associate for Strategic Planning at OSU's Institute on Women, Gender, and Public Policy, and also Nicole Dunn. She's the President and CEO of the Women's Fund of Central Ohio. So when we hear stories about these kinds of statistics, they don't suggest Ohio is a friendly place for women who want to achieve, especially young women who are thinking in those terms much more, well, I guess we hope. What do you think, Julie?
Well, it goes back to, you know, a comment you made is in terms of what's the chicken, what's the egg. I think one of the issues we have to address is looking at ways to make staying in Ohio and trying to build a career here attractive, really both to young women and men. The state has long been concerned about this idea of brain drain. And if we're losing our best and brightest to other states for their entry-level job, it's highly likely we're not going to get them back in the future.
Nicole, does that make sense to you?
It does make sense. And again, I'll just reference our focus on girls. And it's looking at that decision to go to college. And if they can enter college, and that decision is what we're finding being made by the time they're 10 to 12 years old, if they are expected to or anticipated to attend. And if that access isn't available to them here, you know, how can they then be productive citizens and stay in Ohio?
So what are some of the better states? Who are we competing against?
Well, if you look at educational attainment, some of the places that you would expect to be high, Washington, D.C., which is included in the rankings, close to 50% of their workforce, female workforce, has four or more years of college. Massachusetts is the next highest, with 37% of their female population age 25 and older having a college education. So there are some of the coastal states that you would expect, but there are a couple of Midwestern states that also do fairly well. So it isn't just an issue of kind of geography in the middle of the country. I think it goes back again to some of what the industry has been like in the state. You know, here in Columbus, we think about it being primarily white collar, primarily service, but there's a lot of the state that's had to go through an evolution and is really looking to what's the, you know, next generation of jobs that will hopefully attract and retain recent college graduates to stay in the state.
What about men? I hesitate to bring it up because I don't want it to be a battle of the sexes things necessarily. I assume that people think this is not good for anyone in the state when the achievement levels are so low. So, but how do they compare in Ohio? Is it very much of a difference?
For men, it's about 25% age 25 and older have a college degree. So they're somewhat comparable. I'm not sure what the ranking would be for men. My guess would be it's in the same arena. And again, I think you see more conversation about the fact that to grow the economy here in Ohio, one of the critical issues is getting kids, not just kids, even adults, to go back and get an education beyond high school. If you look at for women, four or more years of college is what it takes for their median earnings to actually exceed what a man with a high school diploma would, their median earnings for men with high school diplomas. It also, for women, has a significant impact on the likelihood of them ever living in poverty. 4 years of college or the equivalent, and I say that because of the skilled trades as being another option, it reduces the likelihood of poverty from 12% to 3.9%. So my guess is that you see similar impacts on men, but when women start with lower pay jobs and jobs that may not have the same benefit package, and it has an impact over their career over a lifetime, it just has a compounding effect.
How much does womanhood get in the way? In other words, people who have babies, they raise families, does it affect women more than men? again, I don't know if you're actually comparing it to men that way, but Nicole, maybe you can talk about that and what girls' ambitions are in those directions and how that affects things.
Well, one thing that I can continue that conversation about is that we did find that girls who lived with a single father were twice as likely to not be in poverty, or let's reverse that.
Okay.
Women with a single mom were twice as likely to be in poverty in Central Ohio, and this is as recent as in the last year.
And I guess that gets at the issue of why should the rest of us care? We should all care when we're dealing with poverty issues like that.
Well, I think why we care is because of the children.
Right.
And so it is, you know, when you think about that, it's often the mom as the primary caregiver. What comes with that situation then is one, two, and oftentimes three as your average demographic of a single mom living with three children under the age of 10. And then the challenge is to how do we afford childcare, transportation, and then expected to go on and get a higher education in order to get a higher earning job.
What are the statistics now as far as the number of women or the percentage of women that are single parent, are head of single parent households? Do we know? Has that changed much over the years, or is it still greater than single parent households led by men?
Absolutely.
Okay. By far, there's no comparison. So, okay. And so when you are the single parent and you're female, the chances of going on and getting an education are much less than a male, or it's pretty much the same for both. It's just that there tend to be more of them.
Well, you alluded to some of the issues that are somewhat specific to women, especially if they're a female, single female heading their household. Whether it's pursuing an education or pursuing a career, we're still in a situation where having a family, having children, has a negative impact on women's ability to pursue either one. And until we address some of those issues, in terms of making it easier for women to manage that piece of their life as well as pursue an education or pursue their career, we're going to continue to see women lag behind.
Okay. We have got a call from Abe. You said the problem of education in Ohio, it's not gender related. What is it?
It's a general thing. Education in Ohio has not had the priority that it's supposed to have. Of course, there are gender problems. The gender difference, and they are accentuated in terms of the girls and the women. But the problem is systemic. The problem is systemic. Education has not been valued. It's been talked about, but in terms of funding, in terms of everything, we don't operate at the same level as other states. And it's not surprising that we have the brain drain. A lot of the girls, friends of my daughters, have gone to Chicago because it's a much more vibrant city. I've often said Ohio is not a state; it's a state of mind, and everything is shortchanged, and it's equal for boys and girls. But of course, because of disparities in, there is some gender effect, which is much more important for the women. And that's the way that I've seen it for years, and it's my feeling about it.
Okay. Julie, Nicole, what do you think? The gender effect.
I think there is something to be said there, and I want to know if Julie took a look at any updated information about entry into college, because we talk about these barriers, we're talking about the results, but when you look at just the statistics of women entering college compared to men, when we did our Count on Her report that Julie's very familiar with just 5 years ago, there were more women. So 54% of those entering college were women and into graduate school, but less of them were then graduating. So what is happening? What is that difference, barrier, disparity? I'm not sure. But when you just look at what the numbers are saying, something is being fed into that. So is that the need and drive because there are more women working in the workforce at a younger age. So then, therefore, it drives just economical needs to have dollars versus time for education.
Right.
I guess the thing that it's important to keep in mind, and I don't know these numbers off the top of my head, but for women in particular, the age diversity of a female college student is more significant than men. Some of the research that's been done, at Ohio State, has looked at the economic value of a college education for women, and the fact that because it has such a significant impact, if you go back to the median earnings that I mentioned, because it has such a significant impact, that's part of what has driven more women onto college campuses. And actually, women get the majority of degrees, at least at the undergraduate level. But I think you see people like my sister who got married and had a family out of high school, but when she went back to work, realized very quickly that for her to have anything other than an entry-level job was going to require her to go back and get an education. And so she finished her bachelor's degree, but she was in her 40s when she did that. And that's not – I don't think that's an atypical case for women, and I think more so than men in terms of seeing that diversity of age.
Another report out of the Institute on Women is Grandma Goes to Work. And it was a catchy little title. It caught my eye. And someday. And it said that of particular concern in the past year has been the influx of older women, 65 to 84 years of age, either retired or widowed, who are entering or being driven back into the workforce by the current economic climate and the loss, in many cases, of pensions and or health benefits. So there's another diversity thing issue there that it's broadening, that it's – you're mm-hmm. counting women now that are much older than perhaps you used to count?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I mean, the Department of Labor has been tracking the workforce by age since 1948. The interesting thing about the stat for older women, 65 and older, is that their workforce participation rate is the highest it's been in that entire period, and for the reasons that you've mentioned. Now, that trend tends to take an uptick anytime you run into an economic downturn for the same reasons. But it's the highest it's been, in the history that we have. And as the article you mentioned actually references, the kinds of organizations like the New Directions Career Center, who works with primarily a female population, getting them ready to pursue a job, is seeing an influx of women in that age group that they've not seen before.
And so how does that differ? What's your understanding about how that differs then and how they treat them? How do you juggle those kind of needs and backgrounds?
Well, that's part of the challenge they're facing, because for a lot of these women, they either haven't been in the workforce for a significant time or may not have ever been in the workforce. And so a lot of the new technologies that are used on a day-to-day basis are things they're not necessarily familiar with. They're also, for this age group, the access to benefits, health insurance is all the more critical because the increased need that they typically have. And so they're dealing with these women's fears that they won't be able to find a job that will either have health benefits or pay them enough that they'll be able to afford the benefits. So, for the New Directions Career Center, I'm sure other similar organizations, they're having to kind of re-gear to a whole new set of issues that they've not dealt with in previous demographic groups that they've worked with.
What about the Women's Fund of Central Ohio? Forgive me if I'm wrong, but I sense that a lot, and from reading about it, that a lot of the thrust has been on younger women, planting those seeds, teaching them how to be philanthropists, and also teaching them how to benefit from philanthropy when it's appropriate. What about older women?
It's a great question, and there's no doubt that it's on our radar, and because it's a recent highlight that's come to our minds is that we're seeing that in our grant applications, and our fall grant cycle has just begun. And so as we begin to read these 30-some applications that have come in, we're seeing more around entrepreneurship, innovation, older women, how do we connect and engage them that we haven't seen before. So it's something new for us to explore, because we've been very balanced in saying, okay, leadership for women, economic independence, and then the life skills for girls piece has always been there.
Right.
And for us, that is our emphasis right now for the next 3 years, and we will continue to balance that with our annual grant partners.
Okay, we have an emailer here, And I guess she just went away. Oh, she asks, I think it's Charlotte. She asks, what programs are available at OSU for older women like me who would love to go back to school? I mean, is it out there?
Sure. There's one program in particular. It's called the Critical Difference for Women. It's managed out of the Women's Place at Ohio State, and it's a pool of funds that are available for women who, older women who now want to go to college, who either want to finish a degree that they started or pursue a degree. And it provides grant funds in support of their enrollment in at Ohio State. So that's one in particular that targets women who have probably had a gap between when they may have started college and now that they want to finish it.
I guess there's also a proportional fear or trepidation about going back to school when you're in your 60s and what sort of benefits you might get from it at that age. I hope to be working well into my 70s, actually. Mm-hmm. I think we're all kind of reframing our references as far as what's, a typical age to retire and that sort of thing. It's just tougher when you're having to go back to work after you've been out of the workforce mm-hmm. for a long time. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how women still lag behind men in political leadership and education in Ohio. Does this have anything to do with that brain drain we're always hearing about? We talked about that earlier. Now I want to know about the political leadership part of it. And 20 years ago, when I was covering the State House, there seemed to be a lot more women down there than there are now. Have you noticed it? Is that what you're looking at when you're looking at legislative representation by women?
Yes, if you look at the trend in the state legislature in Ohio, what you'll see is a big jump starting in 92, which was the year of the woman in politics. There was an increase at just about every level. We continued to climb, and that was probably to some extent. I mean, it was the time period where Joanne Davidson was the Speaker of the House, so you saw more women, an increasing number of women, and women in leadership roles. The challenge here in Ohio is in the mid-1990s, we peaked at about 24% of the seats held by women in the state and have declined since then, as low as 15-16% of the seats back in 2007. Now, the good news is we're starting to make our way back up in terms of numbers, but as I think you indicated earlier, we still rank fairly low in terms of the percentage of seats in our state legislature that are held by women.
Right, 33rd, and for such a populous state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's an improvement from where we were a couple of years ago. But I don't know that it's – I mean, I think it – while it's an improvement, it's an issue that we really need to focus on. We need to get more women in elected office in Ohio. The state legislature controls an awful lot of things that impact people's lives on a day-to-day basis. They control how a lot of federal dollars are used. They control regulations on things like child care. It's an important place for women in Ohio to have a voice that speaks for them.
How about political participation, Nicole, as far as the Women's Fund of Central Ohio? Is that a goal? Is that a topic that you discuss?
Politically, we're nonpartisan.
Right.
However, we do want to take an advocacy stand. And right now, we work through our grant partners to reframe some of the work they're doing to say, how can you make a greater impact? What do you need to go and change legislation? What do you need to have a stronger voice in doing policy change? And that fine line is also a lot of education to have nonprofits be aware that this is not lobbying, it's advocacy, and we will fund advocacy. So we have seen a significant shift in the kind of application that we're receiving from nonprofits because of those conversations, so much so that in 2 years' time, we've had one application fully fund a position where there was none 2 years ago to spread their word. The other piece to that would be talking about just having a voice. The leadership for women is be an advocate, vote. Get out and vote. And I believe, and again, I'll turn to Julie, our expert, to say, is there a correlation between the number of women voters that are going out to vote to the number of women faces they see that they're voting for.
Okay, and we'll get right back with that after this break. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a recent report by OSU's Institute on Women, Gender, and Public Policy that shows Ohio lagging in indicators of women's advancement. When we return, we'll talk about more of that with Nicole Dunn of the Women's Fund of Central Ohio and Julie Graber of the Institute at Ohio State University. What do you think? Call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org and let us know. We'll be right back. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we're joined by the NBA's most valuable player and the highest paid athlete in the league, LeBron James. His new book, Shooting Stars, is about his early years in basketball, in junior high and high school. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Support WOSU Public Media by becoming a volunteer today. WOSU is currently looking for a daytime volunteer to assist with the administration of the volunteer program. You must be computer proficient, and you may go through an application and interview process. For more information on this and other volunteer opportunities, visit us online at wosu.org/volunteers. And tonight at 8, President Obama will address a joint session of Congress to talk about his plans to overhaul the nation's health care system. Melissa Block hosts the coverage from NPR with analysis from reporters and newsmakers. Listen to live coverage tonight at 8 on WOSU 820 NPR News. In the weather forecast, sunshine this afternoon, there is a slight chance of rain and a high of 78. Clouds tonight with a slight chance of evening rain and a low of 55. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Do women still lag behind men in political leadership and education in Ohio? One study by the OSU's Institute on Women, Gender, and Public Policy says yes, they do. One reason might be term limits when we talk about politics and women's access to elective political office. Julie, what do you know about term limits and what correlation there might be at least?
Well, I think there's a general sense when you look at folks who kind of study this issue that while everyone acknowledges that term limits initially was a good thing because it opened up seats that had been held for a long time so that women could run for an open seat, in a lot of cases, I think a lot of states have seen that it also where they do have term limits, it became a detriment to women because that wave of women who kind of came in the early 90s ultimately term limited out. And we didn't have the second wave ready.
Okay. And so there's an organization. It's called the White House Project. And I guess the ultimate goal is in the title of the organization to get a woman in the White House. Didn't happen this time around, but one of the major thrusts of it, the group, is to start very, very early, very young, and at very grassroots levels, and that the open seats because of term limits was just kind of an artificial way to inject women into the process, that you need to start younger and have women with more advocates and that sort of thing. What do you know about that, Nicole?
Well, there's the White House Project, and then the counter project with that is Vote, Run, Lead.
Okay.
So it is all about have a voice, get out and vote, run for office, and then lead your office and be a leader in civic leadership. And it's, that goes beyond just what's your call to duty once you're elected, but fill that pipeline that Julie's talking about and be mindful. Bring women with you. Bring it along. And starting young. Start young so you can be actively engaged, be an activist, be an advocate.
It seems simple, so why don't women do it? Why don't enough women do it so that there's that volume?
There are a couple of issues for women running for elected office that they've identified. One is the age-old problem we talked about earlier. How do I manage a family and a career in elected office? And women are judged differently for having younger children
still
when they run for elected office as opposed to men. Second thing is it's tougher for women to raise the money they need to run. And the third and probably most important is it for whatever reason, women don't think about what about running for elected office. They don't think about actually having the skill set that they need to run effectively and then work in the office effectively. I don't know why exactly.
It's because they're not an insurance agent.
Well,
and in Ohio, if you're an insurance agent,
but women know everything about putting together a group of folks and raising money for projects. It's easier for women to ask for money for something else than it is to ask for money for themselves. The final thing that I want to talk about is connected to not we don't think about it. There's research that shows that women have to be asked 3 times to consider running for elected office before they will. So one of the things all of us can do is take those women who we think of as being smart and very capable and ask them to run for office. And if they say yes, then help them generate the support that they need.
We've got Kelly on the line. Kelly says she's a graduate of the White House Project in Columbus. Kelly, what's your experience been?
I thought the White House Project training was fantastic. It was life-changing. I think it's a wonderful program, and I hope that they bring the training back to Columbus again in the future. The women who were involved in the 3-day training session were just such a fantastic group of people. I met so many women who are so involved in their communities, trying to create change and working hard to better themselves and their communities.
What did you learn, Kelly, about what you weren't doing? What did you learn there that triggered a response in you to act?
Oh, my gosh, so many things. I learned about how government is structured, how the process works, how to get involved with groups so that you can build a coalition of supporters so that when the time comes that a local office opens up, you're prepared to run. I learned about fundraising and how it works. I learned about advocacy positions and how those are developed and how to follow the proper channels to government via, if it's the state house or commissioners' meetings or school boards, so that you can create policy change.
I guess a lot of candidates are brought up through the system via the political parties, and those are still not universally but still largely controlled by men. And it's not, I don't think it's a sexist thing. I think it's just a natural thing. You're going to talk to your buddies about something. You're going to make them feel more comfortable about it. Did you find that, Kelly? Or did you come up through the political parties?
Well, not really.
Okay.
I've tried to be involved with my party of choice and found that it is a very structured hierarchy. So the way to open doors is to get involved at the grassroots level, to start small, and you make a name for yourself and you make a difference. You have to show through your own record of hard work on the ground, wearing out your shoe leather, that you're someone that they should look at.
Was that your experience that you had to be asked 3 times to run, or am I assuming, making too much of an assumption, that you've ever run for political office?
Absolutely. I think it does take at least 3 times, maybe even a little more of a nudge.
Why do you think?
It's scary. You're putting a lot on the line. And for me, as a parent, my main concern was how living a public life would affect my children. When you speak out politically, it affects a lot of things in your life. It affects your relationships with extended family, with your neighbors. Sometimes it affects your job. So you have to walk a fine line and be very careful and think about your family first.
Okay, Kelly, thank you for joining us.
Mm-hmm.
What do you learn about these kinds of dynamics when you're looking at statistics like the one girl, the first comprehensive study of girls in Central Ohio, Nicole? What did that study tell you about these sorts of scary feelings that women and girls have about things as natural in a democracy as running for political office.
That they're real, that they still exist, and that there's been movement. But when we have the economic turn that we've had, and I'm talking about single mothers, it impacts it. And we say we've accomplished so much, but when we look at single moms and children, we have to say, okay, where's the education? So looping back to education and recognizing, you talked about STEM, and that girls are doing better in math now than they were before, but they're still lagging behind in science. So what's going on there? And when you think about leadership positions, girls are not the ones to step up. It's the boys.
Mm-hmm.
So what messages are they hearing in the schools? What messages are they getting through observation in their community and in their household? So you heard Kelly talk about it's your family first. Is the dad thinking that, or is he thinking, I'm the patriarch, I'm going to be the leader, I'm going to be the forefront spokesperson of the family? Not saying that's across the board, but what mentality is there for the caretaker?
What do you think, Julie?
Well, I'm hopeful that that it's changing to some extent. We talk about kind of the younger generation of women who are coming up, who are going into college and then coming out and starting their careers. There are a group of young women who, one, participated in sports, so understand being a part of a team, have had more experience with competition and winning and losing. If we're lucky, if depending on their environment, they've been told there isn't anything about being a female that needs to hold them back. I don't know how they react. They're going to react when they get into an environment, say a work environment or a political environment, where gender does have an impact. But one of my hopes is that they'll push back. They'll help us push back on these issues that have affected women for so long to the point that we're not dealing with them anymore.
You told me earlier about the new leadership program for college junior women.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about?
It's a program that's been offered. It's a national program out of the Center for American Women Politics at Rutgers. Ohio State has had a program, I think, from their initial year, so 8 or 10 years at this point. And it's a week-long program for college women who are interested in running for elected office. It brings them in here to the Glenn School and gives them the opportunity, similar to the White House Project, to learn more about what it would be like to run for elected office and to serve an elective office. I think the other message that it really reinforces is, you know, when we see an issue that we care about, that we want to see change, I think for all of us, a reaction is, I'll go get involved in an organization that provides services around this issue. By being in elective office or at least working in a public policy arena, it significantly expands the number of folks you can impact. If you can impact a public policy around an issue you care about in a way that you believe would improve it, it's going to impact a whole lot more people than the number of folks that you can maybe serve on a volunteer basis. And while that, I'm not saying that's not important, I'm also saying I think one of the messages they get is if they want to really have an impact on an issue, public policy, having an impact on public policy is a way to go.
Why college juniors?
Well, the program's targeted at college juniors so that they still have a year in school that they can go back and share some of their experiences with other students. And it gives them a year to start thinking about, you know, when I leave college, when I graduate, whether it's a year or a couple of years, you know, I can start planning now for a job in public policy.
Okay. Still gives them some time. Nicole, that's part of what drives the Women's Fund and starting out young. In 8 years, what have you learned about that? About starting young.
Young? That does have the long-term systemic change.
It does.
It does.
How
it
do you measure
does.
That now?
That's what we're going to do with our One Girl Initiative,
oh.
is really hone
okay.
in. It was perfect. It's because it's only been 8 years, but 7 years of grant making, is really taking a look at when it is a slow change, what is the tide that's turning, because it's not going to be a quick impact. It's not just count the numbers of women served, girls touched. It's, okay, what are we doing today for girls ages 10 to 12, and where are they going to be when they graduate? What is different because of something that we've collaborated, funded, partnered with that has created a change, and how do we enhance what's working, and how do we remove the barriers of what's not working? And I'll piggyback on some conversations that I had with the participants of this year's new leadership and your question about asking why the junior year.
Yeah.
In our dinner conversation, there were three young women who said they were going to go back and, with a different lens because of that experience, apply their major differently. So whether it was journalism, how do they infuse advocacy into their major of journalism or photography or whatever their major was, how do they now approach it with a lens of policy change, advocacy, being engaged, fundraising? How do I go back and take this to the community versus got my degree, now get my job, make it a bigger long-term change?
You know, we've got Paul on the line, and I just have to let Paul ask his question because it does sort of beg the whole issue of why we care about women's achievement in general. Paul, are you there?
Yep.
Well, shoot.
Well, I work in the field of sales. And when I call on a client or a potential client and I want them to start using my product in their business or wherever it is, I need to justify why my product should be in their business and what benefit we bring. Do we add strength to them, or are we duplicating what somebody else is doing? I've been listening to you guys for the last, half hour, 45 minutes or so, and not one of you has convinced me that we ought to have a woman in the White House. There's no reason. I don't see it. And, you know, the thing of it is, you've beat around the bush for the last 45 minutes or so. You've talked about the qualifications, you've talked about this, and you talk about that. And by the way, I have a daughter in college in Florida right now. And never once has she said, you know, I'd like to get into public service. Never once has she ever said, I'd like to be president. I don't think women want it bad enough that they're going to go out there and get it.
Okay, well, Paul,
The last woman that I remember was even close to qualified was Elizabeth Dole.
Okay, well, Paul, let's give him a chance to answer because we only have minutes to go. Do we have any time? Okay, we have 2 minutes.
I'll tell you. Here's the deal. Women have a right to be at the table. We make up over 50% of the population, over 50% of the voters in just about any election. We have a right to be at the table and to not encounter barriers. We have a reason to be at the table. Research shows that having women at the table does make a difference. They make decisions differently. They focus on different things. And whether that's nature or nurture isn't important, it's the way that is. And women have a responsibility to be at the table. We need to step up. We are half the population. And a good friend talks about the fact that it's kind of like a light bulb. Why would you put a 50-watt bulb in a lamp that would take 100? Why would you not use half of the resources that you have to take on the challenges that we face?
Nicole.
And I think that tide is changing, Julie, because of that and women recognizing that and hearing that message. We're seeing that there are more women that are becoming small business owners, that is what's generating revenue and income, and that women drove, I think it was $4 billion of our economy here in Central Ohio in the last 5 years, and that women who are CEOs of companies have healthier employees, have more diverse population of employees, and have higher revenue within the first 5 years within their startup. So when you're talking about generating an economy for the positive, women who are engaged and entrepreneurial and innovative do make that change.
And think what they could do for the rest of the country, I guess is what you want to say. You have been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining me today was Julie Graber, Senior Associate for Strategic Planning at OSU's Institute on Women, Gender, and Public Policy, and also Nicole Dunn, President and CEO of the Women's Fund. Thank you so much for being here today. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.